Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Whereas most of the guests we've had on our show happen to be academics working at universities, it has been a long-standing goal of our podcast to feature individuals who study or do religion who are not directly connected to the academy, understanding that many non-academics have valuable insights into the religious world around us. And today is one of those moments when we are joined by such a guest. That person is Frank Selden, a former Seventh-day Adventist pastor who is now an estate and retirement planning attorney. He also served 20 years in the Washington State Army National Guard, which sent him on two tours of duty in Iraq as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom. He is a graduate from the University of Washington in the year 2000 with degrees in psychology and political science, having managed not to take any courses from me. Good job. And then he went on to complete a law degree at the University of Washington in 2003. Go Dogs! Frank is the author of two books, including Finding Faith in the Fury, One Soldier's Faith-Challenging Journey Through Operation Iraqi Freedom, and most recently, The Suicide Solution, Understanding and Dealing with Suicide from Inside the Mind of Someone Who's Been There, released by Archway Publishing. We'll link to these two books on our website, so please visit us. They are very personal, fascinating, and helpful reads, so get on over to our website. Frank, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
One of the first things that we like to do here on the podcast is get a little bit of history of our guests, focusing on what got them to where they are today. And since both of your books have a very personal element about them, I'm going to ask you, how did you go from being a Seventh-day Adventist preacher or pastor? Actually, how did you get there? And then to become a lawyer and then end up writing two books?
It's a long story, but I do my best. I was raised actually in a Calvinist church, a Christian Reformed church. One of the doctrines of the Christian Reformed church is the Ten Commandments as a vital part of our church service. We would, for example, recite the Ten Commandments practically every Sunday. One of those commandments is, of course, honoring the seventh-day Sabbath, which we would follow quite religiously on Sundays by not having stores open, etc. We'd still milk our cows, but pretty much had to do that. I was challenged once by a Seventh-day Adventist as to why we were keeping the Fourth Commandment on Sunday rather than Saturday. Started researching that, ended up at Loma Linda University in Loma Linda, California. Went into religion studies with the goal of going on to seminary and becoming a pastor. Just prior to going into seminary, the mother of my three children at the time decided that she didn't want to be a Seventh-day Adventist anymore and didn't want to be married to a potential pastor, and she left. The denomination did not accept divorced people as ministers, and so I was asked to leave the program. Pretty heart-wrenching time to lose both my chosen profession and my family all in one summer, but it sent me on a very different path. I, for several years, had believed that I had not met God's intent for my life. There was no way for me to mend it. I was now divorced. I couldn't be a pastor. This went on for well over 10 years, in which most of the time I went back to dairy farming, which is where my family roots are. Then I came to a realization that God can really use us in many different ways. And I turned my attention to other things that I could do. Quite honestly, shared with some of my family members, I didn't really like cows all that much. Dairy farming is not my forte. I'm very glad to have many members of the family still in dairy farming. It is one of the hardest working, most underpaid careers that one could choose in this country. Very grateful for everyone who does that, but that is not me. So I did a couple things to change my life. At the age of 33, decided no longer to be involved in dairy farming. One of the things I did was join the Washington Army National Guard. Dairy farming doesn't pay very well, and I needed pretty much every dollar I could get. The Washington Army National Guard, as a private, doesn't pay a lot of money, but it was enough to make a difference. And I also went back to school. Wanted to get a degree other than something in Seventh-day Adventist religious studies, which I found out in the business world tended not to really open any doors for me. That education path led me to the University of Washington. My initial goal was to become a forensic psychologist. I was in love with books featuring Alex Cross, for example, forensic psychologists going out and solving crimes by studying the mentality of criminals. I loved that program, did well at it, finished up a bachelor's degree in political science and psychology with a goal of going to the University of Washington PhD program. If I had known you at that time, I'm sure I would have loved to take numerous classes from you, but somehow we never did cross paths. This is very true. Interestingly enough, in the year 2000, in January, my senior advisor called me into the office in the psych program and asked me, A, to sit down, and then B, had I applied at any of the other PhD programs for forensic psychology? And I said, no. Why? And she said, because we can't admit you. The university had been sued that fall over its admissions policy. And as a result of that lawsuit, the allegation of which was UW had let in more of its own undergrad statistically than the other schools who had that PhD program, which was true, but wasn't actually against any rules. But as a result of that lawsuit, they did two things. One, they decided not to take any of their own undergrads for 2 years, and my year into that program would have been the first year. And two, they gave someone who had been rejected by all of the schools, or not accepted, it's not the same thing as being rejected, but not accepted into any of the programs, they gave her a seat in my class. So I could have waited and instead decided to find a different path because a BA in psychology and political science also does not open a whole lot of doors. So I considered a variety of different options, chose law school. Knew nothing about law, didn't know any lawyers. But I went over to the UW Law School and I said, hey, how does one get into this place? And they told me, and I filled out all the paperwork. And that fall, I was admitted to the University of Washington School of Law.
Go Dogs. You got that.
Go Dogs.
You got that Husky tradition going there now. So
yes. So it's a varied path. It's a windy path, but that's how I ended up in law school. And I love what I do these days.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, in addition to getting a law degree, you had already been in the Washington National Guard, and to negotiate an undergraduate degree and a law school degree while doing that at the same time is pretty amazing to do that. What was you mentioned your decision to join the National Guard was primarily financial.
Well, there was two components, one of which was financial, but the actual impetus was not what's the best way to make an extra $200 a month.
Yeah.
The Guard isn't it. Don't do it for that reason. The actual impetus came from a conversation that I was having with some friends of mine who were bemoaning the President of the United States at that time for being the Commander-in-Chief and had never served in the armed forces. All of my friends in this conversation, all up in Whatcom County, all of them had military time. I was the only one in that circle who didn't. And I thought, what can I do at 33, then married for the second time, kids, what can I do? I actually looked at joining the full-time army. They didn't want me. I was overage, married, dependents, and they said, no, we're not going to take you. So I tried the Guard, and the Guard said, sure. will take you. So there I was, going off to boot camp at the age of 34, the day before I turned 34.
Oh.
Going off to boot camp, regular Army boot camp in Fort Leonard Wood.
So boot camp at age 34, you're still pretty fit at that point in time, right? How was boot camp at age 34?
Oh, I loved it.
Really?
Oh, I was having a blast.
Okay. Yeah. Now, you also mentioned that you did two tours in Iraq. So when was this, and in what capacity were you serving there?
9/11 happened in my first year of law school. And 9/11 changed a lot of things in this country. One of the things that it changed was the way that the federal government could call the National Guard into service. When I enlisted, there was a paragraph in my enlistment contract, which I actually read. It's one of the few contracts in my life I actually did read. And there's a paragraph in there that said, and by the way, you're subject to call up by the federal government. I asked the recruiter at the time about that paragraph. I said, when and how does this happen? And the recruiter said, that hasn't happened since Vietnam. So I was thinking, takes pretty big major conflict, not likely to happen. I don't need to worry about it. After 9/11, they didn't have enough active military personnel to do a two-front campaign in Iraq and Afghanistan. About 50% of the personnel that were used in those two campaigns were Reserve and National Guard. So National Guard units from all over the country were being called into service. The National Guard unit that I was in at the time was, for the first tour, was a specialized 30-member unit that focused on base operations. And I was the intelligence NCO. We had one intelligence officer. I was an E6 NCO at the time, a staff sergeant, and ran the intelligence section on the enlisted side. So that was my capacity. And we were stationed in Mosul in northern Iraq for a year, for 1 year. We went into Iraq after the official campaign, which was pretty much all active forces that were going up against the Iraqi army. And we all know through the news, might remember, most of the Iraqi army just said, hey, it's the Americans, threw up their hands, dropped their weapons, and they all surrendered. It wasn't a whole lot of conflict. The conflict really started later as a result of Al-Qaeda in Iraq at the time, AIQ, as we called them. And that predominantly started and still today exists. Its last bastion is Mosul, the city that we were in. We were one of the first to receive casualties through IED blasts. We were mortared every day for 6 months on our base. But these were efforts that came after the active army left.
So you were there, and that was your first tour in Mosul. What was your second tour?
Second tour was in 08-09 as the military was coming out of Iraq at a time where there was a campaign promise essentially made to end military operations, end boots on the ground. That transitioned into several years of, and still exists to some small extent, more of a consultant role for military personnel. By the time my second tour hit, I had finished law school, received a direct commission to a first lieutenant, was then a captain in the JAG Corps. And so my second tour was legal affairs, actually working with the State Department in consult with Iraqi government, provincial government in Anbar, stationed out of Ramadi. And my client essentially was the Anbar Provincial Council. Our goal was to help them understand, develop certain legal issues that were going on in the Anbar province, such as why are police torturing people?
Okay.
How do we get them to not do that? That kind of thing. How do we open up the courts?
Okay. So while you were out there, or actually I should say the result of you being out there, you wrote a book a few years later called Finding Faith in the Fury. Now, what inspired you to put pen to paper and to start writing about some of your thoughts, and give us a summary of, it's largely a collection of letters or short stories or thoughts that are in this book. So give us a sense
yes.
of what it is.
Finding Faith in the Fury was actually written in the moment in Iraq. I had requests from people back home to keep in touch. We were allowed to send emails that, unlike World War II, where pretty much all of the letters were read before they went back home, these emails were not reviewed by the military. And I basically had a weekly email that was going out to, at first, family and friends, and then other people wanted to be added on. So this was actually all in-the-moment material. What is life on the ground? What are people doing? What are soldiers doing in Iraq? How is the battle affecting us? That kind of thing. I did not start with the intent of turning all of those into a book. It was my way of expressing myself in my downtime, just doing some writing, reflecting at something that works really well for me, and sharing that with people that I knew. It wasn't until afterward I'm home and not writing anymore, people were saying, you should turn all of this into a book. And so with the five or six people that told me that, knowing I had five or six book sales guaranteed, I decided to do what was necessary to turn that into a book, which actually did sell a few thousand copies. So,
no, that's good. We will link to it on our website. A question, though. The emails, you did two tours of duty. Were the emails from both tours, primarily from the latter tour?
Finding Faith in the Fury was in the first tour. Okay. The second tour, I did not create such an email list. My mentality was actually quite different on the second tour. The first one, I was very gung-ho about all of the work that we were doing in Iraq. I was excited about it. We were bringing democracy to this country that was under a dictatorship, even though he was elected every year as the president in elections that looked a bit shaky from our end. But he, 94% of the people are voting for me. So I was quite excited about the mission. The second time around, I wasn't. When I got into the country and saw what had been created as a result of all the work that we had done the first time, I was not just not excited about it. I was actually angry about it. I could see that we did not bring a true democracy to Iraq. We did not give them the opportunity to struggle and wrestle with ideas like we had during our own founding and have these different conventions and solve our own problems and create our own constitution. We handed them the government in a box and did not really give them any options. And by the time I got back the second tour, I found that a lot of Iraqis were pretty upset with the United States government and the way that it handled Operation Iraqi Freedom, and they wanted us out.
So let me take you back to the first tour, and
yes,
you're excited about things, and you're writing, you're sending emails, and you're putting these in the book, which again, we will link to, because it's an interesting read. They're in the moment types of thoughts. The book, though, is entitled Finding Faith in the Fury. So there's a religious undercurrent. Not all the letters are religiously based or anything like that, but there certainly is an undercurrent throughout the book. So tell us a little bit about the religious component, how that played into your writing emails and your thoughts at the time.
One of the prominent incidents that happened on our base, again, being one of the first bases that was hit with that kind of activity, IEDs, etc. When we first got there, we had a lot of canvas Humvees and life was good, but when everything started hitting, we weren't prepared for that. One of the convoy trips, one of the first convoy trips on our base where IEDs came into play, we did have a lot of Humvees with up armor kits, and people may remember that there was this huge cry for up armor kits for Humvees from all over the place when the IEDs started becoming prevalent. There was a convoy that went out from our base. We had on our base a lieutenant colonel chaplain, Roman Catholic, and I talk about him in the book. He prayed for all of the convoys. all of the convoys going out, he was there no matter what time of day, prayed for them, held chapel services on our base, both Catholic and Protestant and whatever people really needed. He was our only chaplain. He attended, went along with one of the convoys to a forward operating base where he was going to conduct mass for some of the Catholic soldiers. And I understand in the Catholic faith that is, mass is very important. So this IED went off. In the summer, we're wearing all of this battle gear that we're supposed to wear while inside the vehicle. It's 130 outside. Air conditioner's not really working well. Everybody's sweating. Blast window is open maybe an inch. And a piece of shrapnel from the IED found its way through that tiny opening and essentially through his forehead. He died as a result of those injuries. Not instantly, but later. But a lot of people started asking on our base, what was the purpose of prayer? If prayer meant anything, if praying for a convoy before it went out, prayer for safety meant anything, if anything would actually happen, the medals that we use, the Bibles that we stick in our pockets, because there's a story going around that somebody was saved a bullet through the heart by a Bible in his pocket. All these things that soldiers do on the front line. If that all actually made a difference, one would think that this lieutenant colonel chaplain, out of anybody in that convoy, would be one that would not be hit, and yet he was the only one, and died as a result of those injuries. People on our base started questioning faith as a concept. It doesn't mean anything. So I discovered that while I'd heard growing up this old adage that there are no atheists in the foxhole, that when people are in the midst of battle, everybody believes in something, I found out as maybe it was not true. People stopped believing. Four of us who had ministerial backgrounds petitioned the Army to carry on chapel services, and we were approved for this, even though we were not chaplains, with the understanding that this was going to be in addition to and not interfere with our regular duties, that we were also already working like 80 plus hours a week in our regular duties. And we all said yes to that. And so the four of us basically rotated different parts of the services. One of us would be in charge of music, one would be in charge of the sermon, one would be in charge of everything else, and one of us would have a week off. And we rotated that on a monthly basis. So that we would cover all of the aspects of the service until a chaplain arrived. We started with maybe about 20 people attending our services, and by the time we left that base, that service was over 100 people in attendance.
Wow.
The message was getting out. We did not necessarily provide answers. We provided a forum for people to discuss these issues. Some of the questions that people wrestled with turned into parts of what's in the book. So there's definitely a religious theme to it in parts of it, but it was also still stories, what's going on, what are soldiers doing, how are we reacting to things. But this is a reaction. This is a real reaction that soldiers are having to the battle. And it affects our mentality. It affects whether we are 100% focused on what we're doing. There were people who were distracted by this issue or any other issues, getting a Dear John letter. One does not, after getting a Dear John letter, be 100% focused in battle the next day.
Yeah.
It's difficult. So there's all these personal stories that can affect how people show up in the military. And one of the things that I did write about were those kinds of things. And I was also encouraging people back home who were reading this email chain that was going out on also different ways to support soldiers on the front line. And it wasn't with sending us boxes of food all the time, although that's helpful. But more than that, what kind of encouragement? And I do believe that the United States has learned several lessons from Vietnam. the welcome that I received different times coming back in uniform in an airport is very different from what Vietnam vets received. A very good friend of mine coming back from Vietnam actually spat on in the airport in uniform. We had a very different, supportive, almost jubilant welcome as heroes. And I'm grateful for that. I think the United States has learned a lot from that. I do have some personal reflections that I think the pendulum did swing for a while too far. One of the most controversial writings in the book is one that was entitled, "We Are Not All Heroes." That one actually somehow through the email chain that went around ended up getting published in the Atlantic Journal Constitution.
So let me ask, so that was, those were reflections on your first tour of duty.
Correct.
Here's a little thought experiment to play out here. If you had to write that book again in after the second tour, would you have done anything differently, or what would it look like?
If I wrote a book about the first tour after the second tour?
Or if you had done emails during that period of time, how would the tenor of that book change?
I specifically did not write emails. I mean, I did some, but I didn't create the same kind of email distro list, etc. during the second campaign for a couple of different reasons. One is that I actually came home injured during the first campaign. I was in my own IED incident and spent 6 months in hospitals and learning to walk again. That developed into some bitterness. Even though there were a lot of really positive things in my life, my attitude about the military, my attitude about our role in the world, different things I saw from an officer level that I didn't see from an enlisted level, my attitude had changed. I did not want that change in attitude to infect people. I saw it as something that could be detrimental to troops on the ground. And so I didn't write. I did a few times, but it's like, this isn't what I want to do. So I kept all of those things to myself, really. My role was also very different in the second campaign, and the situation on the ground was quite different. The troops were exiting. The reality is, for the most part, it was actually pretty boring. So it didn't really come across the same. The enthusiasm for Iraq was way down. The election that was coming up in the States, very much concerned about why do we still have troops. So for several different factors, it just didn't hold the same appeal the second time. I do believe, though, that there were a lot of positive things going on in Iraq at the time. We did a tremendous amount of good, still were, in 08 and 09. So there were things to write about. It just was so different, and I was in such a different space that it's not where my heart was at.
So you're in a different space about the military, our role in Iraq, and that. How did your perspective on faith change at this time, if at all?
Coming back from Iraq, my faith had changed. I was no longer comfortable in any church that I could find. It didn't. My faith was so different that I didn't feel at home in any of them. Creeds meant nothing to me. It was all essentially just a pure act of putting faith in action mentality. And so much of what I saw back here in the States in these different churches was, we do a lot of talking and we don't really do anything with our faith other than try to recruit more numbers or raise a bigger budget or build a different building. And I looked at that as a waste of time for me. It's not what I wanted. So I became much more interested in putting faith into action and just doing things and helping people. Organized, structured religion became non-important to me. I flat out didn't care. So it was several years before I found a spiritual community that I actually felt at home with.
So let me go ahead and move to your next book then, too, because this, I think, bringing up some thoughts that are going through your head around this time are well. Your second book is called The Suicide Solution, Understanding and Dealing with Suicide from Inside the Mind of Someone Who's Been There. Give us an indication of why you wrote that book.
I couldn't help not to. It was driving me crazy. 2 o'clock in the morning, I would just wake up and my brain would be writing this book and like, shut up and go to sleep. I'm tired. I'm not interested. But it got to the point where I had to. And again, I didn't start off thinking I'm going to write a book. I just needed to write. I came back from the second tour even more different than I had come back from the first. Another injury, rollover incident, neck injury on top of lower back. My life had really changed. There was not a whole lot that I could do physically. I had been up to then that point a very physically active person. 10K runs and mountain climbing and it just, I hated my life. I flat out hated it. I also did not support the Iraq campaign as I did before. I had a very different view of it. It was more of a, the voices in my head, I had a huge committee of voices inside my head, and some of them are basically saying, no, we didn't bring freedom to the Iraqi people. We brought a box solution that we shoved down their throats. And so in certain kinds of political discussions, and then these thoughts would come out, I tended to, at that time, hang around with a lot of politically conservative people, none of whom wanted to hear that. I started to become very isolated, both in the physical constraints and with thoughts running through my head. Ended up losing a marriage that was very dear to me for 12 years. It cost me clients. It cost friendships. I ended up just being very isolated and alone for several periods of years of my life, and essentially wanting my life to be over. Taking an active role in ending my life on actually 4 different occasions over 3 years.
So you get beyond that. There were 4 different suicide attempts over the course of 3 years. What helped you get beyond it, and how is that reflected in the book that you wrote here?
The fourth time, I was at Tahoma National Cemetery around midnight by myself. Nobody knew I was there. People had thought through some my way of saying goodbye to several people that this was going to be another suicide attempt, but nobody knew where I was, even though some people were looking. The motto of Tahoma Cemetery is "Where Heroes Rest." And that's what I wanted. I wanted to rest. I wanted all of this, these voices in my head, these nightmares that I was having, the dreams, the things that just wouldn't go away. I just wanted to rest. And that is how I was going to get that rest. I'm way out in the Tahoma Cemetery with a loaded shotgun, with the safety off, my finger on the trigger, and all of a sudden visions started showing up. People, ethereally like, I don't believe in ghosts, I don't believe in spirits, I don't believe that there are the spirits of the soldiers hanging around graveyards waiting for somebody like me to show up that they can appear to. I don't know, I have no explanation for what this is, but it was extremely real to me. And there was one, and there was two, and then there was 20, and well over 100. And they were just there. They were surrounding me, like in a semicircle, and they were watching me. Almost like the book of Hebrews, or surrounded by a cloud of witnesses. Here are all these witnesses. And nobody talked. There wasn't a voice, but there seemed to be this thought that, okay, we'll witness you. Go ahead. And I'm looking at them like, I didn't want to be witnessed. I wanted to be alone. Even though they're not, like I said, it was very real, but in some sense, they're not really there. So I basically had a verbal discussion with them about them showing up like this. And I this might sound kind of odd, but, you know, I was in a very odd space mentally anyways. But I had this discussion with them, and they were like, well, you know, whatever, just go ahead. Something inside of me came to the conclusion that I was not going to enter that rest that way. And it really came about because there were people that I knew in Iraq who were buried in Tahoma. Some of them showed up that night. And I knew how they entered their rest. I knew that the stands that they took in Iraq, I knew what got them killed. And there were lots of other people in other uniforms, etc., that were there that I don't know their stories, but my imagination was that they had all... their lives were ended the same way. They were taken from them in the midst of doing their duty, in the midst of doing things that they perceived as honorable. And I said, I'm not entering this rest this way. I took the shells out of the shotgun, disabled the weapon, walked out of the cemetery, made a phone call, and turned myself in. Knowing that I had broken several federal and state laws that evening, knowing that this could cost me my license to practice law, although I wasn't doing a whole lot with it at that time, knowing that this kind of trauma in my life, I might lose relationships or family members, etc., it was so strong in me, I'm not going to end my life this way. I didn't know how. I just knew I would never commit suicide again. And there has been ups and downs, but I've never gone back. I've never gone back. The cycle was broken.
You mentioned that you had broken a few federal laws during that. What just out of curiosity, what was that, and what became of the phone call saying, hey, I'm here, I'm turning myself in, come pick me up, et cetera?
The Sheriff's Department showed up. They made sure that I was safe. They are also, of course, making sure that they are safe. Here is a veteran with a weapon, suicidal, on federal property with a gun, which is illegal. And I had also done a few other things that night, but essentially leading MPs and State Patrol on a wild goose chase. But the result of all of that was, they decided that I was not a harm to themselves. They turned me over to an ambulance who strapped me down in a gurney required by law. You know, I'm a suicidal, unpredictable. So I cooperated with that. Went to an emergency psych ward inside a hospital where I'm inside this glass room that I can't get out of. Veteran services have an inpatient program, and essentially the determination was made that evening by a psychologist on staff at the hospital who was not a VA member or veteran, but it was her determination that I would be well served by going through this VA program with the support of my family, etc., who I didn't know at the time, but there was about a dozen of them in the waiting room. Some of them ready to hug and kiss me and glad I'm okay, and I'm sure some of them ready to kill me. It's sort of like if a teenager comes home way in the early in the morning after you've been worried about them all night, and one of the first things you say is, I could kill you right now, but you don't. You love them. It's that kind of mixed emotion. So she had talked to a bunch of my family members, and she thought, you know, they're going to do more to him than we probably ever could in the hospital if he gets out of line. So I'm just going to turn him over. So the decision was made not to turn me over to the criminal system, but instead turned me over to the VA mental health system. I, for one, am quite grateful that that system exists. In King County, for example, we have a separate veterans court that veterans who are arrested with certain kinds of issues or behaviors can actually be tried in that court rather than the criminal court. The goal of that court is to discover whether the veterans may be eligible for certain kinds of services that can get them back on the right track, rather than sending them to jail and sending them on a downward spiral of this continuing criminal type behavior and activity. I am very grateful that these alternatives exist, because that ended up also being part of saving my life and helping me get back in productive activity, not with a criminal record, not losing my license to practice. So I'm grateful for that part of the story. But it did have me volunteer, or being sent to, if I didn't volunteer, a one-month treatment program. That program helped me see how I was developing the stories inside my head that were leading me down that path. It also helped me rewrite stories and create different results. I also saw in that program other people who were there, some of whom this was not their first time through that program, who had been on suicide watch numerous times. I also saw ways in which the program was not helping people. And it was a very specific incident where that I am observing an interaction where I came to the conclusion, we're approaching this the wrong way. That individual over there is not being served. I was, but there were people who were not being served by this system. And I started to think of different ways that we can reach out and help. That basically planted the seed of all of the research that turned into this book.
So let's turn to that book right now, because it's not only the typical research that you might see in a psychology class, etc., but you include a lot of interesting historical ideas about how suicide has been dealt with over time in different faith communities. And that's one of the aspects that is in this book. It's not the main aspect, but it certainly comes through in a couple chapters throughout the time. So let's start with that and look at what you... Well, first of all, what prompted you to take a more historical approach? It would have been so easy to write a book that said, hey, I've been through this. This is what you should do, and this is what you shouldn't do. Why did you think about going back all the way to Greek and Roman times and then through Christian history?
Questions that keep popping up that people still have today have part of their answer in this history. And I believe that if people understood the history, we can make decisions about where to go from here rather than being stuck in certain cycles. That is what the cognitive processing therapy of the one-month inpatient program actually taught me. Take a look at my own history. See how these stories are developed. See where the dialogue is coming from. All I was doing with this book was applying that theory to the construct of suicide. Where do all of these ideas come from of how we deal with suicide? And it's quite a complicated problem. It's a lot of different pieces. In a discussion on a college campus, one of the college students asked whether all suicides go to hell. This is a relevant question, but it has amazing historical context and all sorts of different ideas that come into play. To me, the 100% answer to that question is much more than a one-minute answer at a college campus dialogue. I'm attempting to answer that here. I do see it as containing a lot of different factors. First of all, why do we believe in hell? Where did that come from? That's a discussion all in and of itself. What kind of judgment sends people to hell or to heaven? Who gets to make that judgment? What is it really based on? The dichotomy between Augustine and Martin Luther on this issue continues to play out in theology, even amongst people who have never read Luther or Augustine. They're asking very similar questions. So I'm approaching it quite broadly and allowing people to develop their own answer, but I do believe that the history is very important on this issue.
So give us some flavor for what you found in that. You already mentioned Martin Luther and Augustine, but you also take this all the way back to the Greeks and Romans in the pre-Christian era, and then also take a look at some of the instances of suicide that are mentioned in the Bible. I think there were 7 instances mentioned in both the Old Testament and New Testament.
Yes. So I don't hold myself out as an Old Testament scholar. I did do several years of New Testament research and studies. But culturally speaking, from the Old Testament, I find it somewhat interesting how we arrive at some of our current theology, such as our Washington State definition of marriage is, well, it's been changed, but it used to be one man married to one woman. Well, through most of the culture of the Old Testament, they practice polygamy for several different reasons. Suicide has not been, through all of this history, the issue that it is today. There were times where suicide was an honorable approach to particular issues. You can even just take a look at the Japanese culture and when warriors were expected to do an upthrust with a twist of a sword and take their own life as the honorable thing to do. So there were honor suicides. And then there were also dishonorable suicides where someone, for example, Judas, having done something so dishonorable that there's no recovery from this, the only thing that one can do is really end their own life. Suicide sometimes is not in and of itself the issue. It's what did the person do with their life that is more of the issue. In a modern context, we can take a look at Robin Williams, who had issues that I don't understand, and I don't know. A lot of people have written about it, even people who knew him and don't really understand the extent to which he battled with things in his own mind. I don't hold a judgment over him, and I think a lot of people don't, because he created such a wonderful life for many of us with his humor, his comedies, movies, etc. And yet there are other people who may do the exact same action of ending their own life, and we judge that differently because their life didn't amount to much. Well, we can see why they did it because, I mean, shoot, they were nothing. So a lot of times it's not just the suicide in and of itself that creates a lot of these feelings, but a judgment about the person in the context of their entire life. And we see that in the Bible too. There's the different stories, the different suicides in the Bible. For example, Samson, he committed suicide. He pulled down the pillars that ended his life and the life of a lot of other people who were enemies of the state of Israel. So he's a hero. Good job, Samson. We also see that same suicidal ideology play out on the battlefield with soldiers. If I run into the battle, into fire, gunfire, to save someone's life and die in the process, versus put a gun to my head. Both ways, I'm ending my life with a bullet. I actually had the intent on my second tour in Iraq that it would be fine with me if I died on the battlefield. Some type of not direct suicide, but indirect. Suicide can actually be looked at as a spectrum. There's things that we do that are not good for our health. Eat hot dogs. Hot dogs are not, in my mind, really big on the suicide spectrum. They're toward the low end, you know, and I still eat some every now and then. Not as many as I used to, but suicide can be viewed as a spectrum. And one way that I look at it, just the way that my mind puts things together, is that even though we treat one as a hero and another with scorn, the one who runs into gunfire for heroic purposes versus the one who puts a gun to their own head, both are dying by a bullet, but we treat them so differently, even though the one who's running into gunfire may be choosing to do that for reasons that we don't know, that they're okay with ending their life that way. So one of the things that I took away from all of this, the ideas, is that we don't really know enough to make all of these judgments. And I recommend in the book that one of the ways that we can solve suicide is, one of the pieces to the puzzle is to examine this judgment piece. Where did this all come from? And a lot of that is religious history. There is a lot of judgment about suicide over the centuries in the religious history. It did not start out in the Christian tradition that suicide was necessarily a bad thing. Especially if you could work suicide into martyrdom. But is purposeful martyrdom and suicide the same thing? I'm willing to die for my faith. I'm willing to get crucified upside down or whatever. And early Christians were not afraid of that. They would say things against the state. They would do things that other people might say, don't say that, that's suicide. Well, they were going to say it anyways. So does God look at that as, great, you killed yourself for a good cause. Sweet, you get a bonus place in heaven. When we look at the book of Revelation, martyrs have this special 1,000-year reign with Christ that nobody else gets. There was, even in the Christian tradition, and still is to some extent, a special place in heaven for martyrs. But there was a distinction clearly made in the 300s that was not for suicides. People who took their own life did not get the, even if they did it for supposedly Christian reasons, they did not get the benefit of martyrdom. One of the books that I read on the subject that talked about that confusion of that line between martyrdom and suicide, these kinds of, I'll just go ahead and do something that ends in my death and make it look like a martyrdom for Christianity because A, I get this special place in heaven, and B, the church is going to take care of my family. And there's so many of it, it's like bankrupting the church. And so the church is like, no, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to take care of your family if you're just causing your own death and labeling it as martyrdom. And so the church started to draw a distinction very early on in official church history. We don't actually have a highly organized body up until Constantine. And when that organized body is coming into play, it's also, like most organized bodies, starting to pass some bureaucratic administrative rules. And one of these administrative rules was that doesn't count. So there comes into the writings at that time, like Timothy is cited in the Timothy of Alexander cited in the book in the 300s as drawing a line between whether the church was going to make a plea to God to have this person enter into heaven if they had committed suicide, because people were willing to pay the church to make these kinds of prayers. And he was basically asked, you know, should we do that? And he said that the priest has an obligation to inquire into the individual's state of mind. And if the person was not in control of themselves, was his defining factor, although he didn't, it was not in English, and I there may be some subtle nuances in Latin, but the English translation that I was looking at is not in control of one's mind, then we could make such a prayer and receive payment for making such a prayer. Is also implied. He didn't mention that part, but that's part of it. Whereas if there were factors evident that they were in control of part of this, And he also cites, for example, they were just not paying attention to circumstances. That they still have, they had control, they just weren't exercising it, was different to him than someone who is not actually in control. So he seems to be drawing a line that now we might call mental illness. If they had a true mental illness, if the mental illness was controlling, they were not controlling. They were a rational being versus irrational. So we would make supplication for mental illness, but not if someone had some control over their life. That concept later gets switched, where even parts of the church itself is ready to condemn people with mental illness or mistreat them in part of the history. And I want people to see that. I want us to take a honest look at how have we, as a secular society and as a religious society, treated people, suicides and people with mental illness over time. I think it's important for us to look at that and learn some lessons for that so we don't repeat them.
One of the most interesting and compelling parts of the book, which is compelling start to finish nonetheless, is your discussion on this, specifically the asylums that arise in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, and how this changes. And you actually call attention to a couple of reform movements. One is the Quakers York Retreat, and then also later on John Harvey Kellogg, most noted for cornflakes, but also really makes a change in how we view mental illness and suicide. So discuss your findings on that.
So the York Retreat came to knowledge in American history of dealing with mental illness as a result of a lady who, Dorothy Dix, who ran a girls' school here, came down with tuberculosis. We didn't have a good cure for tuberculosis at the time, and she went to a Quaker community in England because they had some natural treatments that were reported to work for tuberculosis. That Quaker community also was experimenting with the same kinds of natural remedies for people with certain types of mental illnesses. She came back so moved by what she saw there that she actually created some research into how the state, Massachusetts, was handling mental illness at the time, compared to the way that she saw it handled by this Quaker reform in New York. And she presented her findings to the state, who were so stunned at how tax dollars were being spent, essentially not helping people or abusing people. It was beyond just not helping, flat out causing harm. And she presented as this alternative model what the Quakers are doing and how people were responding to that and turning around. It was not part of our thought process here. We didn't hold out hope for reform for mental illness at the time. And so we could just, it didn't really matter because they weren't really human. They were something else. We could treat them the same way we would treat dogs. We would leave them in their own filth and kennels and cages and chained to walls. And she said, no, that's not the case. They will show, they will respond if we're treating them with love and kindness, et cetera, and everything that people might know that the Quaker movement has brought to the world. It's a wonderful practice, in my opinion. I've admired everyone I've known who's a Quaker. So she basically challenged the state to make some reforms, and that was the first larger scale reform movement for the treatment of mental illness in this country, and started treating people humanely. Even though, actually, from before that, when churches were the primary responsibility of taking care of mental illness, they had done so humanely. But as those kinds of duties had shifted over to the state and the state was starting to take care of this, I have not found a conclusive answer for this. I have my own theories. But one of the ways that we could look at this is as God was being pushed away from the definition of a human being, we started to see human beings in a different light. And I still think that we see this echoed today in the way that the state passes certain kinds of policies, in the way that the state might say, we as the superior beings are going to create, I don't know, healthcare legislation or something like that, because all of you are too stupid to really know the complexities of all of this. Free market doesn't really work because people don't, you know, the model, the mentality of who human beings are. But there's part of the Quaker model that says they are all children of God and we're going to treat them as such. But the state doesn't have that view. And these people are different. They don't respond. They respond differently. They don't respond rationally. Therefore, we're just going to treat them any way we want to. And Dorothy Dix said, no, they will respond if we treat them humanely. And so the state actually put a very significant amount of money into the reforms at the time for the dollars of their day. It was a rather significant reform. And it started turning a corner for mental health care in the United States.
You also mentioned one of the people that you most respect and when doing your research was this John Harvey Kellogg. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, respect and find some humor in, et cetera. So John Harvey Kellogg was a Seventh-day Adventist. He ran Battle Creek Sanitarium. The early Seventh-day Adventist church was part of a health reform movement in the late 1800s, early 1900s. A lot to do with the writings of Ellen White, and this was actually one of the attractions, the early attractions I had to the church itself. Her writings on mental illness, how to treat mental illness, were some of the most humane things that I had read. She was way, one might say, ahead of her time, but talking about humanely treating people. John Kellogg decided to take her writings and turn it into practice at Battle Creek Sanitarium. And so they treated people humanely. So Kellogg believed in healthy eating. They believed in exercise, in people getting sunshine, in social interactions, which through the rest of the book is actually one of the themes. It's part of the puzzle of how do we really solve suicide. Social interaction plays a huge role. And one of the things that we need to teach people, a lot of suicidals, is how to create healthy social interactions, because it's a skill a lot of them don't have. But Kellogg was teaching them that. This was a place where people would live until their lives were turned around, and then they would go back home. It's sort of like my 1 month with the VA hospital, except some of this would turn into years. But he taught them a lot of different healthy ways of living. One of the reasons he created Kellogg's Corn Flakes is because we had food processing at the time and the way that meals were created, etc. He wanted to find a better, faster way to feed larger numbers of people while creating a healthy product that was in line with what they believed about the quality of nutrition, etc. My personal opinion is that today's formula for cornflakes probably varies quite differently than what Dr. Kellogg initially created. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know what they look like. But I don't see today's Kellogg's cornflakes as actually a real healthy food. And I'm pretty sure that that's not what he created. So they've mass produced, and you know, that's a whole other different issue. But he had this amazing sanitarium that was creating incredible results. One of the parts of his philosophy, though, that if you read Kellogg's writings, and I've actually read quite a few of them, including his book Plain Facts, he believed that one of the causes of mental illness was self-pleasing. That was a sin. And this self-pleasing, sexual self-pleasing would turn into these mental illnesses. And so part of what he wanted to treat people for was to convince them that that was not something to do. I believe that today we would not agree with him on that issue, although I think we would agree with him on most other things. He was also a strong proponent of animus, and I'm not really sure how that played into it, and it's not a subject that I really know much of anything about. But the masturbation issue or the self-pleasing issue was a huge part of his philosophy. The one suicide that he writes about was the suicide of a young man who had been at Battle Creek Sanitarium, where Dr. Kellogg was trying to convince him that his mental illness was a result of his habits, his self-pleasing habits, could never break the young fellow of it. It was such a shameful thing to do back in society at those days that the son was basically, if I can't be cured of this, I'm just going to kill myself, which he did. And Dr. Kellogg was fairly convinced that this, he called it a wasting disease, had just played its toll on the man's mind to the point where that seemed to him the right thing to do. I don't think that today there, I've not read anything where people are proposing today that that is an initial cause of what turns into mental illness. There are other theories of what can be some of these initial. One of them is a moral conflict theory, which also relates quite a bit to PTSD, by the way. So when I came back from my second tour in Iraq, angry at the government, angry at how we treated the Iraqi people, angry about the fact that we had, in my judgment, not taken sometimes the necessary enough precautions to prevent civilians from being killed. A lot of judgments in my head, a lot of anger, and the system basically said, oh, you have PTSD. You're an angry, violent person. I'm like, well, no, I'm not violent. I'm just angry. But they lump a lot of things into this one diagnosis, the trigger for which they said was being exposed to lots of death, people being killed, this trauma. One of the things that's now coming out several years later is that PTSD can actually have a huge moral component to it, that they're also recognizing that there are people who have these anger issues and not necessarily violence, but the anger component of PTSD, who saw no trauma whatsoever. Now, are people just in the military, people who weren't on the front lines, are they just trying to claim a benefit that they don't deserve? Are they just trying to get money from the government? I don't think so. They've been accused of this, but I think that there is this moral component to it that does create anger in people, and over time, it can create a domino effect to lots of other issues, as it did for me. It's unresolved. It conversations in our head morph it into all of these various different stories, to the point where I have such despair over ever finding goodness and love, etc., in the world, that I want out. I believe that this actually plays a role in why 22 veterans a day are killing themselves on average. It's something the military doesn't address. A friend of mine, on hearing a study that the military was spending $5 million on to understand some of the causes of this anger, this PTSD, this suicide issue, and she said, I'll save the Army $5 million. Stop sending people to stupid wars. I think that plays a huge part of it. Even though today we, quote unquote, have a volunteer army, even though I volunteered for the Washington Army National Guard, by the time the orders came down that my unit was going to Iraq, I can't unvolunteer. We call it a free army. We call it a volunteer army. The reality is it isn't. There were a lot of people who didn't want to go to Iraq that I knew inside the military, and we were basically told, if you don't go, you're going to jail. What kind of volunteering is that? So, or face other kinds of charges, dishonorable discharge, and how that can follow veterans for the rest of their life. It's part of their official record. Oh, wait a minute. Why No, we're not going to hire you. You've got a dishonorable discharge in your records. It's worse than having a mortgage, you know, go south if you're trying to get new credit. It's one of the worst things you can have on your record. And there are people who were willing to go to jail over Iraq and face those kinds of consequences because they didn't believe in that war. I did believe in it on our first tour, and I went. The second tour, I went for a very different reason. But I do know people who made that stand. And we don't have a true volunteer army, which is part of what some of my anger was coming from, is that this whole recruiting program that we have to get so many people into the military, part of it is really based on a lie. And I was angry about that. And I had gone from making speeches on behalf of the Army to recruit people in. I was so enthusiastic. And they go, we love this guy. Let's go send him out, even though I wasn't a recruiter. Because, you know, people are signing up. This is absolutely amazing. Now I come back from the second tour. I'm not doing that anymore. I'm going to go around and tell people not to sign up. Because what you're getting into is not what they're saying. You're signing up for something. We have this ideology or this picture in our head of what we're signing up for. It's not the reality. So that's been part of it. I still think that service in the military, I know several people, family members who have gone in, who've even looked at my service and say, that is an honorable thing and I want to follow in your footsteps. And I don't try to really talk them out of it. I do want them to be aware of a bigger part of the picture, and they may end up doing things that they don't agree with.
So let me finish up here as we have a few more minutes. Yeah. You've led a very fascinating life. You've been through a lot of things, changed your mind on a lot of different issues as just explained here. Where are you at right now in terms of your faith life, and how has religion played a role in your life, and how does it still play a role?
It plays a key role. It's part of me all day long from the time I get up to the time I go to bed. But it's changed. I think of myself more along the lines of spiritual and not religious. Religion, if one depends on one's definition, but organized religion. There's another attraction I had to the writings of Ellen White in the Seventh-day Adventist history, as she preached against Seventh-day Adventists ever becoming a denomination. And there was a group of men who sent her on a mission trip to Australia, and while she was gone, decided to create a denomination around all of her writings, even though the denomination concept was something she was adamantly opposed to. So I attend the services. I work with people along the basic concept of how do we create faith into this world. That's my focus. Making the world a better place is one way we might look at it, but I do believe that there is a divinity behind the universe, expressing itself into the universe, and I want to be part of it. That's the essence of what I believe these days.
And this is why we have people like Frank Seldon on this program, because the lessons that you have learned and conveyed to us through your two books and also talking with us are incredibly important. So I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion. My guest today has been Frank Seldon. Frank, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Professor Gill, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.